we've made in promoting health care for detained immigrants. This is the third year that we've discussed this topic here at APHA, and so I think that for the, certainly the first year, along with a lot of advocates, we were reporting out some of the glaring problems with this healthcare system, some of the omissions in transparency and in guarantees to care, level of care. Last year, we had actually a panel with folks from Homeland Security, from ICE, that were part of the panel with us, and we had a very good back and forth. And the bottom thing you see there, the ICE NGO Health Advisory Group, some of the things I'm gonna talk about are direct results, and I think our colleagues from PHR also had a great talk earlier today, but this collaboration we have with ICE in promoting adequate health care for detained immigrants, I think has been fruitful in some very specific areas that are really substantive. And so what I'm going to do is probably run through pretty quickly the background of ICE detention and the problems we've documented. And certainly we have written a good amount, and others also have written very good pieces on the specific health consequences. But then I really want to focus on a discussion of what we've achieved in this collaborative process and what remains. And I think there are real substantial areas on both sides of the coin. No relationships to disclose. Okay, so this is, I'll go through this briefly, but these are a couple of the key historical changes. I think most people here are aware of the HIV travel ban, which fortunately ended, I guess, about a year ago. These are some key pieces of legislation that impacted immigrants and may have led to their detention. So there were people who were detained simply because they had HIV and they did not follow all the exact rules and procedures to leave the country, get a special waiver, come back in. That piece of legislation, though, is 2008 PEPFAR funding under President Bush, actually, and then the federal rules just went into effect. So that's a done deal, but it's certainly 15 years of shame for us. 1996 is really what I'll point out. This piece of legislation called ERIRA, which has a lot of words in it, but somewhere in there is immigrant responsibility, really pushed the needle from not detaining most people to detaining most people. So it really just, you know, shifted the burden of proof and shifted the predominant action to detain immigrants who were out of status. Very significantly in this, and in complete contravention of international law, this also included people who had good credible fear claims. So people who were asylum seekers who said, I have a fear of, you know, one of these protected classes of, you know, for reasons, like for political reasons or gender, they were worried about persecution at home. Those people, a 1996 law said that they could be detained. Now, the Obama administration has undone that recently, and I think they certainly deserve credit for that. And then DHS was created, and when DHS was created, pulled in some of the health infrastructure that's important for overseeing the care of detained immigrants. I won't spend too much time on this. It's a big system. It looks a little bit like a jail system in that people are detained around a month on average. The thing I will point out is that what's very difficult for advocates, for the detainees, and for Homeland Security is that these people are held in about 270 settings around the nation. So those of you who have experience in correctional health, you know, at Rikers, we have a hard time getting a standard established in 11 jails that are 9 on the island and 2 out in the borough houses. So whatever our concerns are with Homeland Security and the adequacy of their standards, it is very difficult, and I would accede quickly that it's a great challenge to try and enforce a level of care across 270 settings, private, public, you know, municipal, all sorts of venues. And then the last thing I think also bears mentioning and repeating, this is an incredibly profitable venture, and that's one of the reasons it's so popular. So the federal government pays a lot of money to correctional settings to detain these immigrants. So while we demonize the for-profit corporations that get into building a jack-in-the-box detention center, the fact is there are many municipalities around this country that take in a good amount of revenue to the sheriff's office or to whoever runs the local jail, and that's revenue that wouldn't come, you know, it's a good profit margin for detaining these immigrants on behalf of Homeland Security. And so I think that I agree that there have been many problems at private detention centers, but I think that when we focus on that, we then don't look at ourselves, which is many of us live in municipalities where our sheriff's department or our county accrues a good amount of money because of this practice. And so undoing this is very complicated because there, you know, there are jails all over the country that probably need to hold 100, 200 criminal detainees that are built to hold 800 or 1,000 because people are smart in the financial sense and they realize as long as the federal government continues to push this money out there, people are going to line up to take it. So I just want to point out, there's a lot of talk in the last year about two different programs. One's called 287G and one called Secure Communities. And I'm not going to get too much into the differences, but basically these are both programs that allow the Department of Homeland Security to harness the resources of local law enforcement. And so one of these programs has to do with basically running lists of, you know, computer lists of who's detained right now, who's held in a jail. The other security, and that's Secure Communities. 287G goes a step further and actually gives specific training to local law enforcement. But part of this now is that the Department of Homeland Security is investing a lot of money into our local law enforcement. So just like our local jails may have money coming into them as, you know, to detain people specifically, there's also a lot of money going into the training of officers and, you know, who buys these computers and where do the computers sit. And there's, as long as this money is flowing out from the federal government to these local municipalities, I think that that's the primary challenge that we have to contend with if we want to undo it. So I think we know that, you know, the detention of immigrants has gone up quite a bit. I always point this out because this is Elizabeth Detention Center. It used to be a food warehouse in Elizabeth, New Jersey. Now it's a people warehouse. So very quickly, as I mentioned, immigrants who are detained may be detained in a local setting. So that is in a federal, or actually it's more often like county jails. They may be in a private setting. The Department of Homeland Security has dominion over this, and particularly ICE. So ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, is responsible for promulgating standards that go to all aspects of detention. So ICE has contracts with all, you know, right now 270 different detention areas. So it's very tricky if you're ICE to work on how to standardize the care that people are given, because people are in small county jails here and there. They may be in a private center. Some of these people are in a few ICE-run facilities, but most of these people are spread out. And then over on the right, you see DIHS, Division of Immigrant Health Services. So this is a group of public health service providers and administrators who have a direct role in providing care in some of these facilities, but also have kind of an oversight role in other facilities. And I think that the uncertainty around how strongly DIHS, the size of their footprint in this system, is a key question. And I think that, you know, in this facilities where they directly provide care, that's, you know, an easy thing to assess. You know, they have a set of standards, they follow them or they don't follow them. For the people who are in county jails where there's no DIHS officers, you know, the question is how can we parlay the expertise of this group of people, DIHS, to improve the level of care in those areas. So these are some of the problems we've documented, and I think these aren't new to most of us, that really there's no Estelle v. Gamble for detained immigrants. There are some constitutional provisions that courts have upheld that, you know, go to the basic levels of care, but there, as of right now, there are some ICE standards, but we don't have a set of federal rules that say this is the law that provides a guarantee for health care for detained immigrants. That's a central problem. Transparency and reporting traditionally has been a problem, but I'll get to some improvements in that. And the health plan and medical standards also, we have some improvements and I'd like to report. So others before me, and we certainly have complained a lot about this thing I have on the left called the health plan. What this is if you're in a detention center and you need to go outside for care, colleagues from PHR reported on this morning. There's a whole process where local facility doctors will ask for permission and it'll get granted, a little bit like an HMO giving you approval to get an MRI. So ICE has decided basically to open up on this. And so the new development in this, there are two developments. One is the health plan itself is more clearly defined, not as a set of standards, not as this is the clinical decision making, but it's simply a reimbursement tool. And so the two changes they're making is they're making it very clear that this thing that we have traditionally called a health plan is not a health plan, it's a reimbursement mechanism, and that they're not going to say no to anybody. So those are, I think, in a certain light, those are positive changes. I'll get to some of my concerns about that. And in the medical standard, there are probably, I don't know, 30, I think, standards about detention for ICE, and one of them is a medical standard. This standard we worked with ICE for starting in 07, negotiating back and forth, and has been really significantly improved in the last go-around. So this is the old health plan, and so I'm gonna skip over this because these are the critiques I've always made, that it's for acute care, that there was some unethical language in the plan about limiting the amount of work that doctors could do on behalf of immigrants. And as I said before, just recently ICE has decided that instead of trying to prescribe through reimbursement what kind of care gets delivered, they're going to open up the floodgates. So they're going to say, we're going to provide reimbursement, but we're not going to provide guidance on what care should be delivered and should not be delivered. So the progress that's been made, the first thing is the number of facilities, and ICE recognizes this as, you know, they know this better than anybody in this room, is if you're trying to assess not just the adequacy of healthcare, but just overall things like how many people are there, how do you move people from here to there? I mean, this is basically a deportation system. So how do you deport people? How do you get them out of the country? That is much more complex for them when they have a lot of facilities. And so they are in the middle of cutting down drastically the number of facilities that house people. And I think that that's progress in that fewer facilities is better for, like, QA and the level of healthcare. Fewer facilities can be bad for detainees if the facility you have to go to is 200 miles away and then you don't have access to legal care or your family or, you know, other things. So it's, I don't want to put that out there simply as a step forward. Screening and classification, these are two areas where at the NGO, ICE NGO Health Advisory Group, we've worked most specifically on. ICE has agreed on a universal intake screening form that we think is up to the task. It certainly is basically a NCCHC standard level of intake screening that would happen when people come into a detention center. They're also rolling out in six facilities, I think, a medical classification system that will allow them to, you know, when they find somebody with CHF or they find somebody with pulmonary hypertension or somebody with a low CD4 who has AIDS, by dint of having higher levels of medical classification, that will inform where they need to go and the level of medical services that are available. And so we think that that's a step forward. I mentioned some of the changes to the health plan and medical standard. I think those are areas where improvements have been made. The thing I'd like to caution, though, is the health plan, which is now what we refer to as like a reimbursement mechanism, simply saying that we're not going to check, we're just going to reimburse you for every type of care that you want done, that doesn't necessarily get you any better care. What it does is it hopefully will eliminate these situations where somebody, you know, the Castaneda case, where somebody needed a penile biopsy and it was refused because somebody said it was elective. So that kind of horrific case hopefully would be eliminated. What doesn't happen, though, is, you know, you're not giving anybody any guidance. So you may have care that's provided that's unnecessary that leads to adverse outcomes. And, you know, this is true of every health system. If you say everybody can get an MRI all the time, some of those people are going to get MRIs who shouldn't have. You're going to find things, you're going to do interventions that will cost a lot of money, but they will really cost your patients adverse outcomes that were unnecessary. Detention managers. So this is, ICE has decided that they're in the process of hiring up 52, this is the numbers there, 52 of these detention specialists, and these are managers that are going to be around the country, and their job is to make sure that the facilities that are in their catchment area are keeping up to standards that ICE sets for them. And so I think this is a real significant move. I think that the 80 in that number is that these 52 detention managers will cover about 80% of the population. That is to say, some of the smaller county jails that are far away or in the middle of nowhere may not be covered in these catchment areas, but I think that this is really the first significant effort by DIHS and ICE to get their footprint out of Washington and back into the local areas where people are being detained. Transparency, I think a lot of this comes down to some of the recent reporting by ICE about deaths, but also about what they found with their first wave of detention managers. I think that We don't have congressionally mandated reporting of morbidity and mortality, and I think we need that. In the interim, we've gotten some reports about the kinds of care given out, but I think that until Congress mandates that I assess morbidity, not just mortality, and also report that out, I think we really won't get to where we need to with transparency. So the number one thing at the top here, this is a broken system. So we, on the advocacy side, have engaged with ICE in making substantive changes in some discrete areas. But fundamentally, it's a system that's broken. And if you pour the same, if you pour 350,000 people into this system next year, you will have bad outcomes because it's a broken system. So we then engage with ICE, and ICE engages in a lot of mitigation of the harms that come from having people in this broken system. But fundamentally, putting the same number of people into the system results in predictable bad outcomes for people. Legal right to care, it's absolutely necessary that Congress, you know, pass legislation and federal rules are adopted that mandates a level of care for people. Mental health is an area that we're starting to engage with ICE on, and I think that, you know, the one specific situation I'll mention is that when people have court-ordered inpatient mental health, so if I jump a turnstile and a criminal court, I get arrested. A criminal court says, well, he's bipolar, and we don't think you should go to jail for it. You should go to inpatient mental health. ICE now has the practice around the country of grabbing people up in some of those situations and detaining them. And our message to ICE is, somebody's already found this person who's mentally ill. They've already found care for them and a place that will pay for that care. Let that process go ahead. That's our first ask of ICE. And then policies and procedures. That health plan that I mentioned that basically has opened up the floodgates as far as services that can be reimbursed for. You know, any good health system, whether it's the federal BOP, whether it's us at Rikers, I mean, there are people in this room that worked on some of the medical policies and procedures at Rikers. And without prescribing the types of care that people need to get, simply saying that you're going to reimburse all the care that anybody can think of, I think walks away from your central commitment, which is to provide adequate care for people. And then contracts, I think I'll probably leave for another time. So I just wanted to thank ICE and the NGO advisory group, because this is a collaborative process. I think we have a lot of fundamental problems to address, and I want to thank my colleagues at NYU. Thanks.